Welcome to The Rest is Shifty, a podcast highlighting the eclectic legacy of Shifty Records, South Africa's fiercely independent cult record label operating through the dark days of apartheid into the democratic era. I'm Warwick Sony.
And I'm Lloyd Ross. Each episode will feature a classic album from our catalogue. Today, Own Affairs by the Kalahari Surfers.
Sing uit gesang 31, Al Vyf Verse.
Well, the Kalahari Surfers began as a sort of accident and came out of a number of jams that my friend Hamish and I used to do.
Hamish Davidson,
someone I'd grown up with in Westville, in Durban. We started guitar together, we started learning chords. We played Creedence songs, he was a Hendrix fan, I was a Who fan.
And the carrots stare, puffy eyed orange peel, sun beating down the thirsty retreat. Sucking dust from the land. Where we nailed the live mongoose to the three-stage fence. In the hope of rain.
We liked rock music, we liked prog rock. We went down to Record King, we bought records, and we started smoking marijuana together. Through the realizations you got with smoking weed was, number one, a kind of access to a deeper understanding of certain musics. Like, for instance, Hamish and I, when we were in the army, listened to the entire Bob Marley's Exodus. We went to Hillbrow Records. I remember buying it there, going back to this flat that we were staying in Hillbrow, and we smoked a big joint and we listened to the whole of Exodus. Once, we just listened through just to the hi-hat. Because reggae drumming was so unusual. It was always, it concentrated on beat number three. So you had, and just that. We listened to the whole fucking album just listening to the hi-hat. So we examined that record totally.
But you guys were playing already,
Yeah, we were musicians. We were in the medical corps band.
Where did you meet?
We were at school together.
Oh, right.
That's complete coincidence. Hamish and I were at school together. We grew up in Westville. We started playing guitar and listening to music in his bedroom. His father was the Westville doctor. Hamish had older brothers and sisters. And as a lot of my friends who had older brothers and sisters, we got a lot of music that came through them. And I remember when Hamish and I started experimenting quite a lot with smoking weed, we started listening to kind of weed type music, and that influenced our jamming. You know, we often used to do these long psychedelic sort of drones and jams. The two of us went to watch an Indian concert in Durban at the City Hall. And we just couldn't get over how incredible they were. Again, you know, it was the marijuana insight, what Herman Charles Bussman called the recognizing blues.
Except it wasn't blues.
It wasn't blues, but it was recognizing the music.
You were in it.
Right in it, man. Mm. And we understood how Indian music system worked, the tabla, the counting. I mean, it was a concert with sitar, tabla, and they had some South Indian stuff with a mridangam. And then a guy in front counting on his fingers. So if it was a 7-beat cycle, he counted 7 on his fingers, so he knew where bar 1 was every time.
For the audience?
No, for the musicians. That's how Indian music works. Often a little bit guy counting on his fingers.
Really?
So they can see.
He's conducting. He
kind of conducting, especially when there's quite a big ensemble.
But surely they know where 7 is?
No, it gets quite difficult, especially if you've got a 17-beat cycle. You've got to go 10, 7 each time. So you need to know as one comes, they put their hand out like this.
So now 1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, it's 4 is tintal. Da, din, din, da, da, din, din, da, da, din, din, da, da, din, din, da, 1, 2, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 1, you know. So that's kind of how they count. They open their hand out. So we had this huge realization and got into Indian music. We were doing TM, you know, because of the Beatles. Hamish and I loved the Beatles. We did TM together. We bought our mantra at the TM Center for R5, the two of us.
And you can't tell me what it is, eh?
No, I can't tell you. It's a little snippet of the Vedas, some Vedic chant.
And you remember it
Yeah, I still meditate. Hamish actually became the sort of heroin junkie of meditation.
Oh, you don't have to tell me that. I remember recording the Happy Ships, which will come a little bit later in this podcast. But when we were recording that, we had to, I think it was meditating 4 hours a day, and it interfered with our recording.
Yeah.
And we had to wait for him.
Well, this album, Own Affairs, was supposed to be the Culinary Surfers. It was me and Hamish and Brian Roth, who was a drummer, who was also a Durban guy I was at school with. Brian and I, the late Brian Roth, I might add, who passed away last year, I think.
Yeah.
Brian and I went in the same class. We were both Westville High and Hamish. You know, we were like really into Stanley Clarke and those guys who could play what Frank Zappa called widdly widdly wee.
You know, I've always wondered about that comment by Frank Zappa because he actually does a fair amount of widdly wee himself.
He's the widdly wee king. And he goes, I think he invented widdly widdly wee because he had George Duke, who was also later on a widdly wee expert on keyboards. Yeah. So, but it's a good comment. So we were into all that stuff. We were into quite progressive rock, Indian music, and that would have been in school, so that's 75, you know, around there, 74. And later on, we got drafted into the army, and bizarrely enough, we ended up in the same actual army camp, which was the medical corps. I was actually initially called up into infantry, but because I was a Hindu, I was then involved with the Krishna movement.
Apparently you were the only Hindu in the South African Defence Force.
I was only Hindu in the medical corps. I'm not sure how many others there were, in, for instance, in infantry, but I suppose...
Well, they didn't call up anybody else but white people, so...
Yeah, that's true. And it was a little bit of a surprise for them to have a Hindu. And then I converted two people. I think Hamish and I think Michael Chase were the two people who became...
But you weren't evangelistic about it, I presume.
No, I think they wanted to escape having to do Bid Parade. Because at Bid Parade, you had to go down into the parade ground and part of a mass of people where the Hindus could just stay in the bungalow and read.
And they used to apparently let you into the food store because they didn't know what to feed you.
Yeah, I was very strict vegetarian, no meat, fish or eggs. I had to eat with the kosher guys. They didn't boil their beans with meat. And I pretty much lived on cheese. I think Hamish was also vegetarian then, and we were doing TM still, because we started doing TM at school when we were in standard 8, standard 7. Hmm. We were young, and that was the Beatles. It was because of George Harrison and the Maharishi. And remember, the Beatles went to Rishikesh.
Oh, of course.
They did the whole White album. They did...
Sexy Sadie.
So for Hamish and I, there was a very creative period. We learned a lot of music. We jammed. We worked out systems, I guess, together. And we wrote songs and lyrics. I often wrote the lyrics. He was more into music. He got into jazz in a big way later on. He studied jazz, actually. And I was the person who loved recording. Then after the army, we jammed a bit. We had a little band in Durban. And we recorded at CNG Studios. Somehow or other, we raised money to pay for, I think, a morning, a few hours. And we just went in there with no preconceived music. We just jammed. CNG was a guy called Don Clark, who had a studio in Westville. He recorded Zulu music mostly, and he was famous later on for that accordion player that became huge, the Zulu accordion player.
Vusi Klimba.
Yeah, that's how Don eventually kind of made his money back. So on that recording we did, it's called Beat About the Bush was the single, Ooh. Yeah. So we were in the army in 76, came out in 79, fucked around a bit in Durban, and then I came down to Cape Town. I think we both did. We went to UCT and we studied, we got into doing a BA. And that's where we started recording in Hamish's, his folks had a house in Obs, and we started recording stuff on cassettes there. We made our own drum box by recording onto cassettes and then playing back and re-recording the recordings. So we'd play the recordings of percussion that we'd beat around. We played tins and pots and pans, and that was 81.
So when was Burning Tractors Keep Us Warm?
1981.
Okay, so that's an example.
Gross Asphalt Products was Obs Productions. That was earlier. That was 79, I think. And that was a Porter Studio recording. That would be 1980. We recorded around the same time. So the cassette album called Gross Asphalt Product was released on Obs Productions, still Varsity period. The name came about as a result of this guy in Germany hearing the Beat About the Bush tapes. A friend of ours was working at Sea Films, which was a film animation company. They used to make those animated little puppets, like the Thunderbirds.
That's right. We both worked there.
Yeah. But we went after hours and recorded onto the 8-track machine. I think we plugged straight into the machine. And I think there's a piece called... And the Germans just gave these titles. They had no titles.
How the hell did they get to hear these?
The Germans?
Yeah.
Well, I wrote to this guy in Germany because I had his LP. I think I got it from Mario Pizarro at Scratch.
Scratch, yeah.
You know, I used to go into Scratch on Sunday mornings and tape record.
That's a club in Cape Town in the 80s.
Scratch was a dub club. Fantastic music movement, because one of the people at Scratch would import records, and it was a way of listening to new music. I mean, they got every month they got a big pile of records
from Jamaica,
from Rough Trade, from, you know, after punk 78 79. By the time 1980 81, music became very experimental in America and Europe. Punk was almost, the doors were open to starting your own studios, making your own records in your garage. I mean, even The Clash had a song called Garage Land. We come from Garage Land. Mm. And we were a garage band, ostensibly Hamish, myself, and Brian. We used to play in his bedroom and then record and then make a record of that recording. It didn't matter if it was lo-fi. It wasn't sounding like Emerson, Lake and Palmer or Wings or something. So the thing about recording, there was a liberation of just composing your own stuff, writing your own lyrics, putting it down, and then selling it on a cassette. So the cassette I sent to Germany was this one that had a whole lot of jams we'd done, and it had the Beat About the Bush piece and Burning Tractors, which were the two tracks that we did at Donald Clark's, which was this one, and you'll hear this is actually Hamish playing bass. And me and guitar, where normally I play bass. There was a drum machine on the organ. So he had this giant organ. So we just composed the song.
Like a mini pops.
Yeah, like a mini pops, yeah. And it had the most, you know, I had these lyrics, pick myself off of the ground, shake my foot around a bit, feels good, taste the air, hamburger and hot chips. Absurdist, abstract stuff that it was putting out. It had no particular kind of political thing or anything like that, but it was just part of the spirit of do-it-yourself.
So how did the German connection work then? So you wrote to this guy and then?
And then he said, oh, this is really cool.
And he was from a band called SYPH, you said?
Yeah, he's from a band called SYPH, which stood for Seifunder Yankee Prügelt Homo. The name of his band was Drunken Americans Beat Up Gays. Apparently at that time, there was a lot of American thugs who were part of the army, I think, and terrorized the Germans.
Yeah, like Elvis was in Germany.
Yeah, they were part of the peace. I don't know what happened after the war. There was the Marshall Plan.
Still a huge base there.
Yeah. And the Germans hated the Americans.
One of America's 750 bases around the world.
Yeah,
where exactly. Where China's got?
Three.
None.
Close. So they were a punk band, Noise. They were really influenced by Can.
We're at war. We're at war.
I got the SYPH album from Mario, from Scratch, and then I wrote to the guy, and then I got all the albums. I mean, I had about five that they'd made. And then he had a record company called Pure Freud. Pure Freude, I think happiness. Mm. I thought it was pure Sigmund. So he proposed releasing a double single, and he did a gatefold, little seven single gatefold, two seven singles inside, with the two tracks we did at Donald Clark Studio. and then two that came out of jams that we did, I think, at Sea Films, actually, which were these with Mbira's and things.
And album fillers.
Yeah.
Or single fillers.
And he loved them. I think the original cover had a photograph of the master tape I sent with the Cokie pen writing on.
Authenticity.
Yeah. So recently, weirdly enough, as we do this, Own Affairs has just been released in France, literally last week. And I've got a pile here of 20 that he sent me.
It looks exactly the same as the original.
He wanted to recreate the original exactly as it was. We've got the liner
vinyl,
notes.
The vinyl work.
Yeah, this is the vinyl. It's got the liner notes in. So Recommended Records put out Own Affairs. The similar thing I did with the Germans, with the Burning Tractors record. After I moved to Joburg and met you and started working at Shifty, I then started working on, and I say I because I was the person who was able in the studio. Hamish was more of a musical force. I mean, he's very good with chords and music theory. And I loved the studio as a recording environment, putting together things
as a creative tool.
Mm. Yeah, because I could play drums, I could play bass, guitar, and those three instruments alone were enough to put down a song on by oneself. And then later on, by the time Own Affairs happened, I was a little bit better at studio stuff, but I learned, you know, through you, actually, I learned how to operate stuff. I remember you used to go off to your farm out in...
Order Eastern Transvaal at that stage.
That's right, yeah, and I'd have the studio to myself for the weekend. And then I'd get in, switch it all on, and nothing would work. And then I had to phone you, and there was some switch that you...
Oh, the dry joint.
Yeah, or something. Learning curve, you know. And then you'd say, oh, no, you just have to unmute the main source control switch. Something like that. Anyway, so I cobbled together this record in between your recordings. We could say after hours in a weird way, because you were full-time recording, say, 9 to 5, doing Bernoldus, if I remember correctly, and...
Mixing Happy Ships...
Happy Ships we'd recorded in Cape Town.
But I probably would have been mixing that in Joburg as well.
Yeah.
And mixing Sankamoto, actually.
And Sankamoto.
Yeah.
So these records all came out in the same kind of energy. At the time, the studio was geared to record the Sankamoto album, which we've discussed in an earlier podcast. So a certain amount of gear was in place. And like the work I did at Donald Clark's studio, I was very keen on using whatever was around. And you had a DMX drum machine. In Own Affairs, the first track was Coming to Terms with That Drum Machine.
Ah.
Yeah. So that's the DMX. So Free State Fence came about as a bass line I did in Cape Town in the earlier Surface period when I used to love working with drum machines. And I had a little thing called a Dr. Rhythm. The Dr. Rhythm was one of the very first drum machines built by Roland. It was called a DR-55. It had a metal chassis, black, looked quite beautiful. Little orange buttons on, off, and you'd use those buttons to stamp in a beat or stamp in silence. And it only had a volume control, tempo control, tone and accent, and it had an A and a B pattern. Each had 16 steps. So you can combine the two. So this could only do 32 steps. And it kicked over because the drum machine couldn't play a 7.
So did this penchant of yours to use interesting time signatures come from your love of Indian music?
Yeah. This is a tabla rhythm called Rubak Dal, which was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, gitate, 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 gitate was the tabla rhythm. And on tabla, you had rhythms that were very nice, 5, panchatal, I think it's called. So this was a 7 that Hamish and I just mess around with. We love these, the thing of a stone jam, and you couldn't figure out where the 1 was. You know, these chords would just arrive out of the blue, and you couldn't find... a rhythmic root, because it felt, especially when you get to more complex timing. There's one I did later on a track that was a shikar tal. I think it was 17 beats. So it's 5, 5, 7. You know, they break it up.
I've always wondered how you kept counts. So you actually do it in blocks.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't do it like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
No, no. Well, you know, everyone counts it differently. I remember playing with this material in London with Chris Cutler's group. So this album, Own Affairs, was released in England through Recommended Records, which was a company that I'd been also writing to.
Okay, so that's a story we should tell just a little bit later, is why we had to get it pressed in England.
Oh, yeah.
And the Happy Ship, same thing.
Totally Wild.
Yeah, that would be song number two, actually.
Totally Wild.
Was the reason mainly for that.
G-strings and fucking VW bonnets, you know what I mean? And having such fucking radical waves, lefts. The surfers are getting fully stoked. I think they're getting a bit jealous, you know what I mean?
Also one of your synths. Which synth was this?
Totally Wild.
This was that...
Oh, the MS-20.
The Korg.
Monophonic synthesizer.
And then this is a recording I did of a guy called Justin, who was a camera assistant. And I worked in those days in the film industry. I think we both did. Well, you did initially, and then you taught me how to do it, and you just carried on working in the studio. And I went out on set to make ends meet. And this guy was so racist, and he epitomized the type of white male chauvinist racist that was part of the surf scene in on the beaches in Durban. So I surfed for a
bit. Surf boykies.
Surf oaks. And they were violent, they were very strong and fit and very virile, and I mean, they used to fight with everyone. You know, if you dropped in on their wave, this guy would fuck you up on the beach. You know, you dropped in on my wave. So as a rookie, as a learning,
it's like saying,
a surfer, learning to surf was
you're checking
nothing.
Me out. It's like saying,
exactly, yeah. Exactly. So Indian fishermen would be on the pier in Durban. You had these long concrete piers that went out, and the guys would fish at the end. And inevitably, the surfers would take the rip next to the pier, so it sucked you out, so you didn't have to paddle through the breakers. And then there'd be the fishermen with their sinkers, and then there'd be fights on the beach between the fishermen and the surfers. So it was incredible violence all the time. You'd go to parties, there'd be someone to smash a bottle and sort of stick it into someone's head or something, you know. So combination.
Heavy O's.
Heavy O's. Yeah, James' soul. So this was a heavy O, Justin. It was a fucking terrible person.
I remember you telling me you were very nervous that he might hear this song.
Yeah, I'm very nervous about him hearing
this. And apparently one day he did hear the song.
He did hear the song. And I was working at Skoltz Films. And I recorded him, we were sitting in the car together, and he was telling me of his exploits as a lifesaver on Durban Beach. All the women he'd been through in that little, he even describes the little lifesaver's hut.
On the table, put a chick on the spread the leg, and the two of us, and we fucking that shit out of it. When I was giving you a shot, my buddy was taking a head job.
So this is verbatim, straight off, I just recorded him.
And he got neck of hard, and I was caught, and we just changed over.
With my Nagra, I mean, I had a very good microphone. And I just let it run.
I've nailed on every beach.
I've nailed on every beach.
I've nailed on every beach.
You know, VW bonnets, which is a woman's bathing costume at the bottom there, they call them VW bonnets. So he goes through all those terminologies that all the surfers spoke of. This is like the Trump tapes, you know. This is exactly, actually. This is like using the Trump tapes, but releasing it out as a, you know, for a discussion.
Hey, come here! Insane.
It's quite a hard one because of the language and the violence of it. But the great thing about it was this beat that Brian Roth laid down on the drums, a very solid. We were very into krautrock. At this time also, apart from Indian and all that, Hamish and I and Brian also got into a lot of the krautrock stuff, Faust, Amandul. And this is very krautrock. It's a synth, DAF or another band. Do you remember Deutsche Amerikanische Freundschaft? Mm,
Walter Mayer's favorite band. No, that's Einschanz, point that other one.
Yeah, the other one. It was similar ideas, yeah.
What is that one again?
Collapsing new buildings.
It's in German.
Yeah. So my dad was a lifesaver. I grew up in that culture. There was a lot of showering with the men, flicking towels, and then the lifesavers at Pirates Lifesaving Club, they had guys they called slaves, which were the young guys who just were starting out.
Roofies.
Roofies.
Yeah.
And they did the most god-awful things to them. My dad was the captain, so he had to oversee stuff. And they had these surfboards they stashed in the concrete building of the lifesaving place. And I remember that in the rain, they'd put surfboard locks around these guys' necks and chained them to the flagpole. And then pissed on them from above, that sort of thing. And then throw sand, you know,
yeah.
That kind of humiliation.
Initiation.
Initiation kind of sort of shit, yeah.
So your dad subscribed to this treatment?
He was a boikie. He loved it. He loved all this stuff. It was hilarious.
We don't like the way they're running our days and nights. Our lives are out of phase. We black, white, separated, right from birth, indoctrinated. Years and years developed apart, brainwashed each in the name of God. SD, educate.
The other song from the album that made it onto, and it's been done a few times, was Don't Dance.
I remember you doing a music video with James and the Lurchers backing you.
Don't dance!
It was a good lyric to do live too, because it was early rap and it was about the army, you know, saying don't dance. I like the idea of not dancing.
To the beat of the government kind of thing.
To the beat, yeah.
Okay, people get up on your feet, it's time to move to a different beat. We don't like the way they run in our days or nights. Our lives are out of phase. We're black, white, separated, right from birth, indoctrinated. Years and years developed apart, brainwashed each in the name of God. It's free.
Was Sugar Hill Gang had the hip bit of hop bit of hippity hop. So what is that called? Rapper's Delight. I quite like those rap. Curtis Blow also.
When facing such hostility, don't
And I learned to play trombone in the army, so I do this absolutely manic free jazz trombone solo in the middle of the live version that I did with the Lurchers, which was a hell of a lot faster than the one that I did on Own Affairs.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Inevitable triumph,
so help us God.
We pray thee that the end of the war may come soon.
Prayer for Civilization was a cut-up of the prayer that the chaplain said on the runway before the Enola Gay took off.
To go and drop the bomb
on Hiroshima. To go and drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, yeah. And it's very much my thematic of religion and war and
irony.
Oppression and irony, yeah. All of those things. Had Rick van Heerden playing saxophone. And then the other one that I wrote here that is quite interesting, I think, and musically quite strange, was Independence Day.
I'm proud to announce this afternoon.
Which starts off with an African guy saying, I'm proud to announce this afternoon that you've again put the government into power through efforts and support.
Through your effort and support.
It's Independence Day. And that was a speech from the Independence of Transkei. The South African way, you get a casino with armed bandits, a national force, Coca-Cola for the masses, dirty movies for the businessmen who've come to help you build your nation. They've come to help you build a nation. It was a song about the... You know, when I worked on documentaries, I spent quite a while in Venda with Mark Newman and Eddie Wes's film Two Rivers. And they had just got independence in Venda. So the thing with the independent homelands was for the white people in South Africa who wanted to go to porn movies and gambling, they could go to an independent, sort of phony independent nation.
Whatsoever ultimately, as far as our art is concerned, it won't be a country, it'll be 8 different countries. Don't understand that? It's going to be 8 different countries, as you have 8 or 9 different countries in Western Europe, as you have about 7 or 6 different countries in Western Africa.
8?
Surely, why not?
And I remember working on these documentaries, sitting there in bars and seeing these guys all coming in from Joburg or whatever to have a good time. You know, so it'd be special hotel concessions, gambling concessions, and so on and so forth. So that's, this song is a kind of an ironic look at that.
So you drew inspiration from the world around you. I mean, like, then Prayer for Enola Gay, in a way, it doesn't fit here.
Yeah.
It's not a South African theme, really.
No, but I found that speech on a record, actually, and I thought, wow.
Pray for Civilization.
Yeah, yeah, and it had the South African thing of Christianity and
killing
war.
People.
And killing people, basically, yeah. I mean, this Independence Day also has this, the second verse goes, it's Independence Day, an architect's dream.
For the new fascist regime.
Houses of Parliament for the new racist regime. Palace for the president, minister's home, mud huts for the laymen, they build their own. And that also is the classic Independence Day, they get a stadium.
Yeah.
The one in Bophuthatswana that I went to, I met these Israelis. Actually, an Israeli girl I quite liked there. And they all were brought to go and to work on the stadiums.
They're building by them.
By them, Israelis.
This before the Chinese started building the stadiums in Africa.
Totally.
So how did it go with the Israeli girl, Warwick?
It didn't work out so well.
Okay.
I think the brothers were hard work.
Oh, okay.
There was like a whole, it just, yeah, right. They're hard work.
My own view is that independent homelands, that is a good thing. And that easily afterwards will prove.
So that is the sound of Piet Koornhof, the Minister of Cooperation and Development, who came through at the end there, an interview I'd found, I think, on radio somewhere. And September 84 was pretty straightforward. Something on page 3 caught my eye. Small print. 37 die in township unrest. Police use tear gas and bullets. Small news this. The headlines celebrate the birth of British royalty. It was very much in the style of a band called This Heat that I loved, that were from Chris Cutler's The Recommended Records catalogue. Very hard, shredded voice and just a groove underneath, similar to the Surface song. It's Brian drumming. I think it was Brian was drumming. I think. Similarly, Telephone was also influenced by The Residents. Again, that same synthesizer we had. Remember, it had a whammy bar.
Oh.
You could get there.
This must have been before we bought the Roland S50 and D50.
Yeah, what synth was this?
I reckon the Korg DX7.
Is it?
Yeah.
Did it have an arpeggiator?
Maybe.
It's got a filter. I love The Residents. So this was... So that was the only lyric. Hands move across things to get at the telephone. That was a sort of a surreal look at The Residents, one of our favourite kind of art music groups then. They had a whole album of 1 minute songs called The Commercial Album.
Not our, your, Warwick. We had different music tastes. I was more pop brain. You were into another alternative world completely.
The whole other world, yeah. There's a Hillbrow 2 was a noise track. It was a very difficult timing, like an angular. I think it was just diminished chords. Hamish and I used to play with these things that if you played a diminished chord, you could play a whole tone scale over it, and you could just play anywhere on the neck and anywhere, and it fitted somehow in a very angular way. So I did this thing in a funny timing, and then it stopped, and I had the sound of a chicona, which is those reeds, those vendor reeds. They go, and they go, that track, I think I was working on it, and one of those guys who did a lot of commercials, top music guy in Joburg, came to the caravan and he heard what I was working on. He said, when that chicona thing started, he said, did you leave the door open in your studio, dude? He couldn't see what the fuck it was. So I remember feeling very embarrassed.
Do you remember the first time we heard the chicona?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? We didn't know what the fuck it was either.
I know.
It was this incredibly sort of mysterious thing drifting over the subtropical evening air.
It's absolutely incredible.
and we just didn't know what it was.
It was like an artwork, you know, if you have to think retrospectively. There's quite a lot of those kind of African moments which you think, if you recreated that now in Paris for some art exhibition, they think you're fucking amazing, yeah? It was like, what, 500 guys with different lengths of pipe.
Each to a different tone.
A different tone, and they'd play them in different rhythmic patterns. Yeah. It's absolutely incredible.
They weren't arbitrary tones either.
No. And it's had a bellows kind of effect. Mm. And I think there was a Gioconda dance that went with it. I read something recently about that. This still goes on.
Just
so that was also out of that documentary, The Two Rivers. Mm. Mark and Eddie's, I recorded the Gioconda there as well. So I got quite a few things coming out of the documentary work. Not only my work, but even your stuff. In fact, you set the studio up out of film industry.
Damn fool, you fucking bastard.
That was, we recorded that.
We tried to work it out for ages and we thought it was Zulu. And then we finally realized, no, it's actually English.
English, yeah, I remember that. That was the recording we did. You and I, we took the ADAT machines in the caravan down to Natal for
Zululand.
To record something for a British guy, a movie about one of those white guys who got washed up on the shores of Natal and became a white Zulu.
Yeah, and I would imagine the lyric here is not totally inappropriate for that kind of situation if you consider how those early settlers used to behave. But I think in this particular case, it was one of the members of this group of Amatomba Zani's boyfriends that behaved badly. Getting this record pressed up was a problem, wasn't it?
Yeah, I took it to...
Because censorship started in a very interesting place in the whole chain of power.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, we had to pay $200 deposit. You took your master tapes to the cutting room, and then Pietman Potgieter was the guy who cut the... He'd take the tape, put it on, and then cut it straight on, yeah.
Cut,
I was sitting there in the room with him.
No, we were sitting
there. We were
there
both
together.
There.
We were doing Happy Ships and that at the same time.
At the same time, that's right.
So he got through one side with Happy Ships and then halfway through the next side. I think we got to the song called You're Not Important. Where the word fuck comes in.
And he
immediately stopped cutting the thing. With your album, I think he got to the second stop on side one and he stopped cutting it.
G-strings and fucking VW bonnets, you know what I mean? And in such fucking radical ways, left.
And there was no appeal.
He kept the $200.
Kept the $200, there was no appeal. We couldn't say to somebody, this is ridiculous, your employee has refused to cut our record.
So censorship began with Pietman.
He played in a Burmese orchestra concertina.
So he blocked this album, he blocked the Happy Ships. But then I sent this tape to Chris Cutler in England and they pressed it. They made this record.
Recommended
records.
And he was a member of the band?
He was a member of a band called Henry Carr. And I think at that point, Henry Carr had broken up and his band then were called Art Bears. I love their stuff. They were very political and they were all communists. When I went to England in 1986, Chris Cutler put a band together for me to play this material in Europe. The keyboard player actually was also from the Henry Carr group, and he was the treasurer, I think, of the Communist Party, Balham. So
Pietman and the South African government were right. You were a communist.
Yeah, I was a... And Chris himself, Chris Cutler, who ran the whole record company, was the drummer for Henry Carr. He told me, I think his father worked for TASS, you know, the Soviet news agency. So they were deep commies. In those days, I didn't really know what it all meant, to tell the truth. I think they were Trotskyists.
They weren't tankies. That's good to hear.
What's a tankie?
The ones that cheered when the tanks rolled into Warsaw.
Oh, right. But it was interesting.
What's the capital of Czechoslovakia?
Prague.
They rolled into Prague.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the tankies. They celebrated. So it was the 80s, you know. There was the Cold War and then the mere illegality of communism. It was like when I went with these guys to Russia, through their connections, I got concerts in the Soviet Union playing some of this material and the next album.
So you must have been pretty much one of the first South African musicians to play, especially white musicians to play in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, there was the ANC's cultural...
Yes, the ANC's James Phillips.
Yeah, that's right. There was a James...
Chorister by the name of James Phillips.
That's right. James and Schlorpy Phillips,
that's,
I think.
That's right.
Yeah, it was confusing. But the cultural choir was there. What are they called?
A mandla,
yeah. I discovered later on that because there was a series of festivals I played at that were sort of things like the Palace of Youth or something. Yeah.
Something North Korean sounding.
Yeah, they had all these palaces. And the South Africans there, I understood, were, I think that cultural choir, mandla, was just thrown together whenever they needed. It wasn't stable people.
Just office workers and whatever.
But the year I was there, Frank Zappa was there. Yeah, there were a lot of Americans sniffing around. It was an opening up. It was Glasnost.
Oh, it was Gorbachev already in?
Yeah, Gorbachev was in.
Okay.
But it was still Soviet Union. It was just after Chernobyl. But you could feel changes.
And how did own affairs go down in the Soviet Union?
The Russians are something else.
Really?
Tell
me about it.
they were amazing. I mean, I met a guy there who had all three of my albums. He came to me and asked me to sign them. I don't know how he got them, you know. So, I mean, Chris's record company had some penetration into the Soviet Union. But it's like South Africa. I mean, I also had all Chris's records here, so yeah. I got them somehow. And you find a way. It's culture, cultural stuff.
And
the Russians were cool that we dealt with. Were fantastic. We're just like my friends in South Africa, but they were going after something different. You know, we were all wanting a communist sort of a government where everyone was...
A socialist government.
We weren't all
wanting a communist government.
Well, you know what I mean. It was interconnected words.
Social really. Democracy, come on.
Yeah. we had the Communist Party. We had the United Democratic Front. We had, yeah.
Well, thank goodness the Communist Party isn't ruining South Africa, but otherwise, you know, we're ruining, I suppose. The ANC's done a good job on their own, but anyway.
No, that's the Communist Party.
Yeah, I suppose.
Zuma brought them in. That's how the communists work. They come in through the back door. They never get voted. Oh, yeah. So we were aiming for a socialist country with a joining up of all the homelands into one country. And the Russians wanted a Christian country with separate countries. It was completely the opposite, but we were the same kind of people. Young people work in culture. You know, it just made me think that, you know, nothing's perfect. There's no utopia at the end of the day. They had a similar disappointment of the future to what we had, where the imagined future in the 80s, if you have to look back now, it never happened.
Yeah, well, the capitalism arrived there in a very different form.
Very different form, and communism arrived here in a different form.
No, true.
You know, we had the old communists who came in with Zuma and took over, called state capture. That's
but
pretty much it.
The interesting thing is that the difference between being an artist like you in South Africa and being an artist producing the kind of stuff that you did on a continent like Europe, you could actually have a career there.
Yeah.
Whereas you could never have a career here.
Yes, most definitely. We couldn't have careers here. Even, you know, that's why I worked as a sound recordist, so I could just do these records that were in arts form that I never imagined ever making a living out of. But even somebody like who wrote commercial music battled to make a living here. Like James Phillips, who wrote very accessible tunes. He had a band, he had everything.
Long hair, we all waited. Many times have we seen.
He had a good voice, you know, he had an amazing image.
In the eyes of the neighbors.
You know, he was a rock star, and then he couldn't.
In the eyes of the neighbors.
But unfortunately, he had to tell the truth.
A feeling that leaves none to guess. Who's been what for who and when? A lesson has been left out there with dust on his dead feet. Shot down in the street, baby.
And that was the problem with his music. You know, he had to express himself through his music, and that was never, ever going to get radio play. And that's the way you make a living out of music in South Africa, radio play.
Yeah, if he'd lived in England, he would have been encouraged. Gang of Four. There was actually something called the Red Wedge, which were the kind of commies in the British music circles.
Billy Bragg, yeah.
Yeah, it was Billy Bragg. There was the Communards. Although it was interesting you should mention this divide between the communists, the socialists, in James' lyrics.
Yes.
Yeah. What was the title of the song?
Heavy O's.
Is that Heavy O's?
Yeah.
So he goes through a list of all the ists. So, you know, when I say communists, I meant socialists. But in England, The Labour Party actually was seen as being communists, although they were actually socialists. But the propaganda, and even now in America, Trump calls the lightest liberal person a communist.
Yeah, no, but that's why I'm asking you to make a distinction, because in America, a light socialist like the guy is probably going to be the mayor of New York by the time people hear this. He hopefully will be. He's a social democrat.
That's right.
And I don't know if you've seen the clip of him explaining what socialism is to the American population.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's basically like we give you a whole lot of shit. We look after you when you're sick. We like, and yeah, it's like, hello.
Yeah, we're wealthy countries like Sweden.
Yeah. You know? But he's not a communist.
No.
No. No, he doesn't want people to go and work in communes.
No.
There's a big difference.
There's a huge difference. But that, that term is bandied about in that way. So in England in the 80s, you had a lot of, you could call it communist chic, Soviet chic. And there's also a difference between the communists and the Soviets, because the Soviet thing was its own kind of brand of, you know, coming out of
Stalin.
Dictatorship, yeah. When I went to Russia, I bought a whole lot of badges with Lenin and red stars, and it looked cool. Mentioned Rick Van Heerden in the Sankamota recording. He played saxophone, he arranged all the brass. He was married to an opera singer, a woman called Anne Buerta. And because of the connection with the Art Bears and Chris Cutler's band, they had an opera singer, a woman by the name of Dagmar Krause, who did a lot of Brecht and all that sort of thing. So I got Anne to sing this song called Hillbrow, which was just about the Hillbrow kind of scene in those days.
So this was before Jonas Kekal wrote his fabulous song called Hillbrow.
Yeah, this is before that, yeah. It's all about mandrakes, and it's actually a guy I met at Rick Van Heerden's house called Gary, who was a Krishna. And Robbie Thorpe recently wrote in his blog a story about Gary Krishna. He called him Barry for trying to protect his... Gary was a Krishna, and he was also, he did a lot of drugs, and he was a dealer, and he was always on the scene. Very pleasant,
so
very well spoken.
So you've decided that Barry's actually Gary?
Yeah. Barry the dog.
But so that, not our Gary.
No, not her, someone. This was Gary Krishna, yeah. Robbie Thorpe said he was dead in his article. I wrote to Robbie and said, no, he's not dead. He popped up in Komiki just a few years ago.
Oh, right.
He came and said hi. He had a beautiful voice, that's what I remember. He's very well spoken, almost sort of a upper English accent, you know. And that's that.
Yeah. Okay. And the rest is shifty.
And the rest is shifty.
You never can be too sure.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's dark here. Living with crime and violence.
You've been listening to The Rest is Shifty. For more information, go to shifty.co.za.
Shiftypodcast.co.za.
Or for downloads, shiftyrecords.bandcamp.com.